So we're working today on Perek Aleph of Sefer Ezra. I say Ezra specifically because we're going to get to Nehemiah, and we'll start again at Perek Aleph of Sefer Nehemiah, but that'll be in several weeks. In the beginning of our period, like usual, I'll ask us just to read through the Perek very quickly, the Hebrew or the English, you know, just to get a sense of the major events and the major activities that we'll talk about. And as while doing that, I'll also ask, if you had to divide up this chapter into sections, you know, what major events are happening in the chapter and what psukim are units or subunits within the perek, what would you say? So reading these 11 psukim, try to pay attention to where there's a division and what, I guess, lines we might want to draw within the perek. Okay, so if we had to divide this perek into sections, what sections would we identify as the major units here?
The first three is the building.
Is there any building that happens in those psukim?
It happens now that they're planning it. They're who's going to go there, who's going to do it, and then I think in four it says, whoever's left, this is what you have to donate to. We got the builders, and we got those who are giving silver and gold. I'm going to get down to 11.
Okay. Oh, sorry. Oh, I apologize. So we'll go through it together then. I'm sorry for jumping the gun a little bit on that time.
It's divided like it stops after four, and then you know this is what we should do, and this is what, and they started to do it, and then the at the very end it tells you how many things of this they brought and how many things of that they brought.
Okay, so I think I happen to like that division. As well, because I think, you know, even just paying attention to the quotation marks in the English side of the perek. So we start with Cyrus or Koresh making a decree. Here's what's going to happen and why, and we'll talk about his motivations a little bit in just a moment. That declaration ends at the end of Pasuk Dalet. And then after Pasuk Dalet, we see the actualization of that decree. Here's what people did in light of the decree. So that's one, I think, natural dividing line between what Koresh says to do and actually doing it. And I think if we want to draw another line, which we could, so we could draw a line after Pasuk Vav as well. So in Pasuk Psukim Hey and Vav, so Koresh says, you're going to go up to the land and people are going to financially support you as you go up. Then the Jewish people, you know, got up to go and they were financially supported. And then from Psukim Zion to the end, we have Koresh himself donating to the cause, and in this case, he contributes the vessels from the Beit HaMikdash, are mentioned in Pasuk Zion. Ve'hamelech Koresh hotziat klei Beit Hashem, the vessels of the house of God, the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash, which are also being returned to Eretz Yisrael at this moment. So we can divide it into either two sections, just after Pasuk Dalet, or even a third if we want, before Pasuk Zion. Those are the three major units we're going to focus on today. So let's read, starting from the beginning, and we'll have, you know, supplementary sources that will kind of enhance some of these details. So we'll start at the beginning. Uvishnat achat leKoresh melech Paras. In the first year of Koresh, the king of Paras, 538, the king of Persia, lichlot devar Hashem mipi Yirmiyahu. At the conclusion or the fulfillment of the word of Hashem by Yirmiyahu, it doesn't say what that fulfillment is, but from our introductory Shiurim, we know that that was Yirmiyahu's prophecy, that there would be 70 years of some kind of exile, some kind of destruction, and then there'll be a return. So we're contextualizing Koresh in the context of fulfilling this prophecy of Yirmiyahu. So what happened? Heir Hashem ed Ruach Koresh. Hashem stirred up or awoke the Ruach of Koresh, the spirit of Koresh, Melech Paras. Vayaver kol b'chol malachuto v'gam b'mechtav lemor. He issued a proclamation and a written declaration as well. Why do you have to write it down? Why couldn't it have just been a verbal declaration? What was the significance of writing it?
You're right, it's more permanent.
It's more permanent, right? You know, we know Megillat Esther, right? Yeah. So what does Achashverosh say after he wants to repeal the decree? Right, Achashverosh says, I want to repeal the decree against the Jews, but I can't because it was written and sealed with the Persian, you know, signet, and it's too late to repeal. So the only solution at the end of Megillat Esther is to issue a new decree allowing the Jews to defend themselves. And that's how the story of Esther ends. So it's very consistent with the Persian, you know, way of doing things, that Ahasuerus was, you know, issued in this written declaration and made it permanent. So Koresh is committing himself to the following. Ko amar Koresh melech paras. So said the king, Koresh, the king of Persia. Kol mamlechot ha'aras natan li Hashem elokei ha'shamayim. All the kingdoms of the earth Hashem gave me. Hashem, the God of the heavens. Uvakad alai livnot lo bayit b'Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda. And he commanded me to build him a palace, a bayit in Yerushalayim, which is in Yehuda. That was the name of the province at the time of the Persian Empire. It was Yehuda. Mivachem mikol amoi hi alokavimo. Whoever among your his people, the Jewish people, whose God is with them, vayal Yerushalayim asher b'Yehuda, vayiven et Beit Hashem, they will go up to Yehuda, to Yerushalayim, they will build the Beit Hashem, Elokei Israel, hu ha'elokim asher b'Yerushalayim, and he is the God in Yerushalayim who you're building a house for.
He sounds more Jewish than some of the Jews.
Right? He sounds really frum.
Yeah.
This is an incredibly frum Persian king. Now, I don't know what his personal life was like. That's a question for Persian historians. But this language, this is incredibly religious language. We'll point out a few examples in a moment. I just want to finish his declaration. But wow, is he frum. V'chol ha'nishar mikol ha'mekomot asher hu gar sham. Anyone who stays behind, anyone who remains. And I think we'll focus more next week on how people actually listened to this proclamation or not. But we'll get to that in a little bit. But anyone who remains, whatever the remnant means, should yinasuhu anshe mekomo b'chesef v'zahavu v'ruchushu v'vehima, will give them gold and silver and wealth and animals. Im ha'nidavali v'et ha'lokim asher b'Yerushalayim. That will be donated as a with the nidava, with the donation that will be brought to the house of God in Yerushalayim. Okay, so things that we noticed. The first thing we noticed is this is very, very firm language. He's invoking Hashem Elokei HaShamayim multiple times, Hashem the God of the heavens, Hashem who is in Yerushalayim. He feels a mitzvah to build the house. He feels like Hashem commanded him to do this.
The word Hashem stirred up the spirit of Cyrus the king. I never heard anything like that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. It's not only is Koresh himself speaking in a divine language, invoking Hashem in a way that's very religious, but we're told that it's almost, we'll talk about what Heir Hashem means in just a moment, but Hashem is involved in stirring up Koresh to this task. Hashem is inspiring him to this. So he speaks like that, and he's being called by Hashem for this purpose. I'll point out one more. This is a subtle point to notice, but how does his speech begin? Ah, okay, so you jumped to right after the introduction, but the introduction is also important. Ko amar Koresh melech paras. Have you heard that phrase ko amar before in Navi? Right? Ko amar Hashem. Zacharti lach chesed ne'urayach avat klulotayich. Just to pick one well-known example. It's ko amar Hashem. Oh, it's also ko amar Koresh. So says Koresh. Right? It's almost like Koresh is a Navi. And that's really interesting, that we're starting off this book of Ezra and Nehemiah, and we don't meet Ezra or Nehemiah. They're not going to show up for another 80 years or so. And we meet a character, Koresh, and unlike most foreign kings that we have exposure to, Koresh is not only, you know, generally a righteous king, he's almost a prophetic king. And that really bears some explanation. How do we understand what the Navi is trying to tell us about Koresh?
Koresh is telling them to charge me to build this structure. They charge me, right? He's certainly a partner for them. Right.
Right.
He sounds more like a leader.
He really sounds like the leader, right? And you might have expected a Jewish leader. Right. You might have expected a Navi.
For him to tell someone else to tell them.
Right.
This is what you're supposed to do.
Yeah, exactly. Hashem tells a Navi, so a Navi could come up and say, it's time to go back to Eretz Israel. And I will make it so that the political circumstances will work out in your favor. But that's not how we're presenting it. We're presenting it almost like Koresh is really our leader.
Right.
And we'll go through the Perek and we'll see the Jewish leaders are kind of downplayed in this parak. There's only one who's mentioned. There are Roshe Ha'avot, who are unnamed. Unnamed leaders are going to, you know, fall further to the background. If they were important, you would name them. And there's Shesh Batzar, who we'll talk about a little bit later also, who's the Nasi of Yehuda. And even Shesh Batzar is passive, right? He is brought the vessels from the house of Koresh. He is given them, and he brings them to Yerushalayim. But he's not initiating this process. He's only the receiver. If we want to discuss that phrase, He'ir Hashem, right? He's inspired. So we can look at different interpretations. We'll see on page 2. Now we have a few different interpretations in the commentaries. And they all kind of, to different degrees, again, play up this divine idea. So Rashi, I think, is probably the most minimal of these interpreters. He says, He'ir Hashem et Ruach et Ratzon. He kind of inspired him to take action, to do something. So it wasn't necessarily like a nevuah, that Hashem really appeared to Koresh and told him to do this. So much as like an inspiration, maybe a Ruach HaKodesh or some kind of, you know, divine inspiration to get going. But not necessarily that you had a direct connection with Hashem or you felt like it was clear that you were speaking to Hashem.
Why would the king of Persia come up with this idea?
Why would they
think that this is, he's quoting Hashem in here. It says, I've been told that I have to build this and you're going to help me.
Right. So why should Koresh be thinking in these terms? Why does it help him? So if it's from God directly, so you understand, maybe he's summoned religiously. Mm-hmm. But if you're just being inspired, so you want to understand what's the basis for that inspiration. Mm-hmm. So we'll touch on that in a little bit. I don't want to jump there. It's a different topic.
Do you know anything about Koresh's background?
We do, and that'll fill in some of these details as well. Okay. So that's going to be very important, right? There are going to be two major pieces of Koresh's background, one from internal information we have in Tanakh, and one from external sources, and they're both going to shed light on this question in different ways.
He's a converso.
There's been a long, illustrious history of Persian Jews, and it begins earlier than we thought, evidently. So Rashi thinks it's just sort of an inspiration, and we have to justify that, which we'll get to. Ralbag says, no, it was really a more close divine encounter. Ralbag, in source number 3, Gersonides, Yedemet, seems to me, Hashem showed this to Koresh in a dream. That's how a lot of nevuah happens. You see things in dreams. And in that dream, Hashem also commanded him to build a bayit in Yehuda. So when he says in one pasuk later, Hashem commanded me to do this, Rabbah says it was a real divine command that came by way of prophecy. Right? Again, Koresh is really being presented as almost a Navi, as a quasi-prophet here. The most interesting answer, I think, well, there's a more interesting answer that falls a little bit more midrashic, so I'm going to save it maybe for another time when the themes of that midrash become a little bit more relevant. It's quoted in Malbim in the further reading sources. But the second answer of Malbim is based on the following Nevuah of Yeshayahu in source number 4. See, this is not actually the first time Koresh has appeared in Tanakh. As far as I know, he appears one other place besides in Sefer Ezra, and then at the end of Sefer Divrei Hayamim, which is basically the same pasuk as we just read, which we saw in our introduction. But he's also referenced in some nevuahs in Yeshayahu, in particular in Perek Mem Hey of Yeshayahu, which is on source number 4. Ko Amar Hashem Limshicho to his Mashiach, to his anointed one, Koresh. I gave Koresh the strength to conquer all of these nations and to open doors that will not be shut. I'm going to give you control of the world. I will give you treasure. I will give you authority. And then at the end of Pasuk Gimel, L'ma'an teda ki ani Hashem ha'korei v'shimcha Elokei Yisrael, so that you know that I am God. So Hashem seems, in this nevuah, to be communicating to Koresh, saying, Koresh, you're going to conquer the world. You will lead an empire that will eventually have Sheva Vesrimu Meya Medina, as we know from the Megillah, 127 provinces or states that are included in the Persian Empire. And I'm communicating to you that you should know that I am God. And then, what are you going to do with that information? So a few psukim later, and I skipped to what was intervening, Koamar Hashem Kadosh Yisrael v'yotzro, Hautiut she'aluni al banayv al pol yadaiti savuni, So I am Hashem. Here are the signs that I'm showing you. Anochi ha'irotihu v'tzedek. I ha'iroto. Heir Hashem. I awoke him. I inspired him with righteousness. With justness. The translation here says victory. I'm not sure which. The chol derachav I asher, and I straightened his ways and I gave him success. Hu yivne iri. He will build my city, Yerushalayim. V'galuti yishaleach. And he will send my exiles. Lo v'mchir v'lo v'shochad. And it won't cost anything. He will do it for free. It is, I think remarkable is exactly the right word. No. This is exactly what you weren't expecting Koresh to be. Right? So I think that that's tremendously significant that we begin this sefer and the story of the return with a foreign king who's more religiously inspiring than a Navi. There's no Navi on the scene, and the religious leaders on the scene are downplayed. Even the fulfillment of Yirmiyahu's prophecy. This is not like Vayehi after Yirmiyahu's prophecy and the years of the 70 years ended, then Koresh did the following. This is Koresh got up and was inspired in this way at this time, kind of in parentheses almost. So really the emphasis is pretty dramatically shifted. And it could be, what I think Malbim suggests based on these Tzukim in Yeshayahu, is that Koresh got this prophecy. Like a real, again, he heard a prophecy, Hashem communicated with him, and so Koresh was fulfilling the prophecy that he knew about. He knew that this prophecy existed, and he was interested in fulfilling it. Whatever you want to say, Ralbag, Malbim, however you want to work this out, we're still looking at a leader who is religiously inspiring. So we have to explain what's going on there. I think from that, we could already try to tease out a couple of different ideas that are relevant to understanding this period. I think one idea that's worth noting is that we're shifting towards the Bayit Sheni period, and one of the major shifts that happens as we move from Bayit Rishon to Bayit Sheni is that we start losing prophecy. There's still a little bit of prophecy at the beginning of this period. We'll probably see excerpts later on from Haggai, Zechariah, Malachi, who are the prophets associated with this period from the end of Treasar in the Nevi'im. There are debates about whether Daniel, for example, was a prophet. Ezra seems to be, he's able to write books that are Nevi'im and Ksuvim, but was Ezra a prophet? Each of these things is, but we're running out of prophecy, whatever we want to say. So, part of showing that is not making the book of Ezra Nehemiah a book of prophecy with a normal Jewish prophet who was called by God and summoned to this task, but by showing that we're shifting modes. We're moving away from the Jewish prophetic period and into a period where political leaders are going to be more important to us. And the spiritual, not to say the spiritual leaders won't be, but the prophetic leaders won't be. That I think is one thing that we get from this. We're already shifting to, we care more about political leaders and less about prophetic leaders.
So what is Ezra's role in this whole thing? Just the taking of the minutes of the meeting kind of thing?
So when we meet Ezra, we're going to pay attention to what he contributes uniquely. I'll foreshadow a little bit and I'll say Ezra's role seems to be that of a Talmud Chacham, someone who reads the Torah, interprets the Torah, teaches the Torah, and presents it for the people. That will broadly seem to be Ezra's role in this whole picture. And even then, it's not like, it seems that Ezra's role is not so political, right? Ezra's not involved in the Aliyah, necessarily. He's not certainly not this first Aliyah. He does bring people with him when he comes up to Israel from Persia as well. But he's more of a religious educational leader, like a Talmud Chacham, like a Rav, and less like a prophet.
What would his response to this king, who's not Jewish, saying, I'm going to build a house for Hashem?
So I think the other thing, right, and this gets to another thing, what else do we learn from this very powerful religious framing that we're seeing? Well, it really elevates the status of this mission, right? You might have thought, right, a person living at the time of Koresh might have thought, this is some Persian emperor, and we've been under emperors before. We were under Babel, we were under different Babylonian kings, Assyria wasn't great for us. I don't care what the local politicians have to say. That's not important to me. And part of framing Koresh in this way gives a lot of religious legitimacy to what he's doing. So don't say, oh, he's a Persian king, he's doing this for his own motivations, maybe we should be suspect of where he's coming from. He's acting as the voice of God. Hashem is speaking to him, and whether directly or not, you know, we can figure out how directly that communication is. But he's really doing a religiously proper thing. And the language of the book of Ezra is communicating that to us, the readers. I think it's another way to think about the significance of that. Because otherwise, what, you know, we have to understand why Koresh is doing what he's doing, and that's very puzzling. And why should I listen to him? He's just some king.
Right. But he's the king of all these earths, didn't it say that?
That's right. So he's a very powerful king, but at the end of the day, I don't build a Beit HaMikdash because some foreign king told me to. I want to do it because God told me to.
Right.
So Ezra Nehemiah is saying, yeah, Hashem is telling you to through Koresh. Okay. And it's not through a Navi anymore because we're shifting gears a little bit.
They're giving Koresh hit the that he can say that I'm building Hashem's building.
Right. It's
sort of putting his passion.
Right. The author of Ezra Nehemiah, which we said probably is Ezra, so he's presenting Koresh in this way to elevate his legitimacy and to show he's doing the right thing and we should be following him. That, I think, is broadly the way to think about it. So that, I think, is you know, one angle on this issue, right? Koresh is fundamentally religiously motivated, and the presentation of that religious motivation is to build support for him and to show that we're shifting away from a prophetic time and more to a more political kind of time.
What was the religion converted at that time?
They were, you know, pagan polytheists like the rest of them. What that means at the time seems to be that every city has their own, you know, most significant god. And or every empire has their most significant god, but there, you know, there are other gods in other kingdoms too. And you know, our god is the best, but not to deny the legitimacy of other gods. So we'll see that there are. Well, we're going to see actually very shortly that there are certain Persian gods who Koresh claims to have a connection to as well, right? So there's a whole other lens to look at this from, and this is a more historical lens. But I think it offers another angle to think about Koresh's work. Around 100. A little over 100 years ago, 150 years ago, apparently, we found something known as the Cyrus Cylinder. Koresh is Cyrus in English. And it's literally a cylinder made out of clay that is inscribed in cuneiform letters in, I think, Akkadian is the language, a proclamation by Koresh. And these used to be very useful because what you would do is you would take the cylinder and you would roll it over like wet clay. And because it has all these indents, it would leave marks on the clay, and you could basically create tablets that would read how you'd want them to read. And the message from...
machine.
Right, exactly. A very primitive mimeograph. Right, a very, very simple tool.
Very cute.
And so we have this. It's in the British Museum now. And we have a record of this this document. And it sounds like what Koresh did for the Jewish people wasn't something he did just for the Jewish people. This was part of his broader political agenda, his broader understanding of how to run his kingdom. In source number 6, I just brought a brief background to understanding the cylinder, but I actually wanted to look at just a few lines from the text of the cylinder. I'll admit I don't read Akkadian, but I do read English translations of Akkadian, and so we have that in source number 7. There's more to it that I didn't print, but this is Cyrus Koresh sort of identifying himself, giving himself praise, and explaining his agenda. So he said, I am Cyrus, king of the universe, the great king, the powerful king, king of Babylon, king of Sumer and Akkad, king of the four quarters of the world. Very impressive king. Son of Cambyses, the great king, king of Anshan, grandson of Cyrus, another Koresh, the great king, king of Anshan, etc., etc. He's describing himself in his genealogy. And he describes eventually how he beat the Babylonian Empire. Jumping to line 24. My vast troops were marching peaceably in Babylon, and the whole of Sumer and Akkad have nothing to fear. I am a powerful emperor who's created peace in the kingdom. I've been very effective at being a strong diplomatic leader who creates peace. And then notably, what's really interesting is jumping down even further to three lines from the bottom, at his exalted command, just in the middle of line number 28. So three lines from the bottom of page number 3. At his exalted command, meaning at the exalted command of Marduk, who is the, you know, one of the Persian gods, maybe one of the senior Persian gods that he serves. All kings who sit on thrones from every quarter, from the upper sea to the lower sea, who inhabit remote districts, and the kings of the lands of Amuru, who live in tents, all of them brought their tribute into Shuana and kissed my feet. So they all the kings are subservient to me. But from Shuana I sent them back to their places, to the city of Ashur and Susa, Akkad, the land of Ishnuna, the city of Zamban, the city of Meturnu, etc., etc. In other words, they would all come to me and they would be subservient to me, and I would return each king to their native land. Right? This was very different from the Babylonians. Mm-hmm. The Babylonian emperors conquered a land and they dispersed the people. They thought the best way to control large areas is to keep people away from their homeland so they don't feel such a strong connection to the land, and they won't be in such a familiar place, and they won't be so connected to their neighbors, and it will make it hard to rebel against us. The Persians have the opposite approach. The best way to keep control over a vast empire is to make everyone happy. Everyone gets to live on their own land. Everyone gets to worship their own gods. And yeah, they'll pay tribute to me, the king of Persia. But that's it. And otherwise, I'm going to leave them alone. And if everyone gets to live in their own places and have that connection to their land, and they get to return to their ancestral homelands, they'll be very appreciative to me, and I'm not going to have rebellions. No one's going to be upset with me enough to fight against me. That's broadly his idea. And he summarizes it, you know, the ancient writings tend to be very lengthy like this, a lot of repetition, a lot of detail. But he talks about returning the gods of each land to their land as well. It's a really interesting document to read historically. This shed, I think, a very different light on this whole issue. Because you read Ezra and you think, Koresh is someone with a connection to God, to Hashem, to our God, who tells him to do this particular thing for us. And it's like a kindness for us and a fulfillment of a prophecy. There's another lens you could take, which is, this was Koresh's general political agenda. Generally speaking, he wanted to bring everyone back to their land, and this was good for him and good for his kingdom. And if you wanted to ask before what motivates him, it's good politics that he should let everyone back. It's easy for him. It doesn't cost him that much. So if that's true, number one, that's a good historical support for our story. It shows that the events were very plausible, because we see that he did that with other empires. It's very plausible he did that with us too. And I think it also shows perhaps a Jewish lens on history, or a Jewish way to read history. Because it could be that you're looking at the historical events, and you could read them in raw political terms. You could have said that he's just doing it for self-interest, he's just doing it to help himself, and there's no religious meaning in it whatsoever.
For him.
For him or for us. It's just politics.
Why would you say for us?
If it was just, as it's described in the Cyrus Cylinder. So you would just say, it's very nice for us. I'm not upset that it's happening. But it's not like the grand fulfillment of a messianic prophecy. It's just politics, right? And you can imagine someone hearing the Balfour Declaration in 1917 and saying, okay, so for self-interest, the British are deciding to let us return to the land. It's not meaningful. And the Book of Ezra is trying to say, no, it's actually very important that we read historical events through the eyes of Hashkacha, through the eyes of Hashem's control over the world and what he's trying to accomplish. So yes, Koresh is doing this with other empires too, but the reason Koresh is doing this is so that Hashem could give us our land back. And Hashem inspired Koresh in this way because of what it does for the Jewish people and the fulfillment of this prophecy that he had promised us.
So does Koresh think that by helping these people, it's another group of people that he's keeping in their own land and helping them out, just like he has helped out all these others, and all of them will treat him as the king of everybody?
That's the political agenda, it seems to be that. That's a great political, approach. And it was very successful. They became a very massive empire. But that's one level on which to read history. The other level, the deeper level to read history, is to see Hashem's hand in history. Right?
What?
to see Hashem's hand in history, right? In 1948, it's very plausible that the UN just felt very guilty and they decided to give us land. Right. Or is the fulfillment of a redemptive prophecy that we're being brought back to our land now after thousands of years of exile? And you could read it in the just raw political way, but Ezra's teaching us in general to look at things in that religious lens and see how Hashem is guiding history in a certain direction. So I think, right, exactly. You can't read Ezra without seeing the contemporary. It's just very natural when you read the Sefer. Okay, so that I think suffices for understanding what Koresh is doing. All right, we don't have enough time to finish everything, and that's okay. So we'll do one more piece, and then we'll...
Maybe we'll read ahead so we know.
Whoa, okay, fine. That wouldn't be the worst thing in the world. We'll pick up with the end of Perek Aleph in a little bit. We'll do one more piece. Which is, so if we continue in Perek Aleph, so in general, by the way, if anyone has their own Tanakh or their own Ezra and would like to bring it, you know, I put it on the sheet for convenience, but it might be easier just to be able to keep pace both in the secondary sources and in the primary source. So if anyone has a Sefer, you're more than invited to bring it. I bring my own as well.
Well, this is
right, so it's nice to have the notes as well. That's true. So continuing on, that's, you know, Koresh and his religious agenda. And if we jump past Sukkim Hay and Vav, because I want to focus on the fulfillment of this prophecy, or the fulfillment, rather, of Koresh's proclamation next week, but just to understand what Koresh was trying to do, so if we jump to Pasuk Zion for a moment, the Hamelach Koresh Hotzi et Klei Beit Hashem, the King Koresh released the vessels of the house of Hashem, the Kelim in the Beit HaMikdash, Asher Hotzi Nebuchadnezzar Yerushalayim, which Nebuchadnezzar himself had taken out of Yerushalayim, so he's undoing it. Nebuchadnezzar did a Hotza'ah, he's being Motzi it back, and returning it back. The name Bevet Elokav, that Nebuchadnezzar put it in the house of his gods, the Babylonian gods, and Koresh is saying no. Vayotiyim Koresh Malach Paras, the Cyrus, the king of Persia, released them, took them out. Al Yad Mitridat HaGizbar, by the Gizbar Mitridat. Gizbar, incidentally, is the word in Halacha for the temple treasurer, right? The one who runs the finances of the Beit HaMikdash. So it's probably a word we borrowed from the Persian, but also the Gizbar who runs their temple is bringing it out so that we could take it back. Vayisparim the Shesh Batzar HaNasi LeYuda, and he counted them before Shesh Batzar, who was our representative, the Jew, the Nasi of Yehuda. And later on in Pasuk Yud Aleph, Kol Kelim LaZahav VeLaKesef Chamesh Alafim VeRameyot HaKol, all of these vessels, these thousands and hundreds of gold and silver vessels, HaKol HaElah Shesh Batzar Im HaYalot HaGolam MiBavel Yerushalayim, all of these were brought back by Shesh Batzar when the exiles went back to Yerushalayim. So what we see here a little bit, and it's going to be emphasized more in other places, is a real emphasis on the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. And if we had omitted these psukim, I'm not sure we would have felt like so much was missing, right? If we went back to Yerushalayim and we built the Beit HaMikdash and we were on our own land again and we made new vessels, that would probably have been mostly fine, right?
Except their old vessels would be sitting in an idol.
So that's true. The old vessels would be in a disgraceful state, and that's a problem. And that's possibly one of the reasons why it's so significant. But in theory, the Mikdash would work just fine if we had to replace all the vessels as well. But there's this undercurrent throughout the stories of our exile, of our, the destruction of the first Beit HaMikdash, our exile and our redemption, that focuses specifically on the vessels of the Mikdash. Mm-hmm. And I'll summarize it. The psukim are here for your full perusal, but just in the interest of time, I want to flag some of the details. So in Yirmiyahu, he's describing what Tzidkiyahu is going to do, and he says what Nebuchadnezzar is going to do in source number 8, in page 4, I'm sorry. And he's talking about all these false prophets. He says, all of the false prophets are saying, you're going to be okay, you should fight against Bavel, you shouldn't serve them, they're wrong. At this point in Sefer Yirmiyahu, it's too late to not be subservient to Bavel. Don't fight them, serve him, and things are not going to get worse. That's Yirmiyahu's commitment. And in that description, jumping to, let's say, verse 16, and I'll read it in English for the interest of time. Also, I spoke to the priest and to this entire people saying, thus says Hashem, don't listen to the words of the prophets who prophesy to you, saying, behold, the vessels of Hashem's house shall now shortly be brought again from Bavel, for they prophesy a lie to you. These false prophets were promising that the vessels that Nebuchadnezzar had previously taken from the Mikdash, they're going to come back shortly. So it's going to be okay. We're going to get all of the vessels back and we'll be back where we started. Yirmiyahu says, that's a lie. It's too late for that. The vessels of the Beit HaMikdash are going to stay in Bavel for a while. Get used to it. But serve Bavel anyway. Don't fight against them and you'll be okay. And in the description of the destruction of the Beit HaMikdash in Malachim, in source number 9, so we see again, Nebuchadnezzar takes those vessels out, and later on in the next chapter, we'll end up destroying the Mikdash and taking the rest, but plundering the vessels is a significant detail being mentioned here. They're being plundered and taken by the Babylonians. And in source number 10, in the book of Daniel, when we describe the conquest of Nebuchadnezzar, he says, Hashem gave Jehoiakim to Nebuchadnezzar, and he gave them all of the vessels of the house of God, all the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. We keep hammering this note over and over, the vessels of the Mikdash, the vessels of the Mikdash. It's so significant that they're taken away from us. It's so significant that they're not coming back yet. It's significant that they're being disgraced while they're in Bavel. In the fifth chapter of Daniel, in source number 11, we see that Belshazzar, who's one of the Babylonian kings, makes a feast and they use all the vessels in the Mikdash. And they all drink from golden cups from the Mikdash and silver cups from the Mikdash. And it's a tremendous disgrace to the vessels. We might recognize this idea most, you know, popularly in our practice in Megillat Esther. Because there are a few psukim or parts of psukim in Esther that we read in the Lamentations melody. Right. One of them is V'kelim mikelim shonim. In describing Achashverosh's party, it says some of the vessels there were assorted vessels used at the party, and the Midrashim assume that's a reference to the vessels of the Beit HaMikdash. Just like Belshazzar does in Daniel, the Midrashim say Achashverosh does in his party. So it seems that it's a really big deal for the book of Ezra, or for Tanakh in general, that we lost the vessels, that they're being disgraced, and now that we're able to bring them back. So we have to answer why this is a big deal. One answer we mentioned is that the reason the vessels are such a big deal is because they symbolize the disgrace of the Jewish people. When we are in exile, we and the vessels of our Mikdash and our whole religion is being disgraced and used for trivial things and used for parties and debauchery. And that's the story of the vessels. They basically represent us. We're being brought into exile with everything that is valuable to us. And that, I think, is one powerful possibility. In which case, bringing them back is just the fullness of our redemption. Is that we're brought back and our vessels are brought back. And it's a full, complete return.
This last weekend, I was listening. I saw he was showing pictures.
Schneer Lyman?
Huh? Yeah.
When was this? Was in
Night of Knowledge.
Yeah. Okay.
So he was showing
Professor Shaivitz in the Rome tour. Okay.
I knew I had the essay. Okay. So he showed the Arch of Titus, and you see them coming, holding the vessels from the temple.
Right. No, that's a great. I hadn't made that connection. Right. But that's the same thing in Bayit Sheni.
Yeah.
When we lose, we are plundered, and the things of tremendous religious value are taken. And when we're rejuvenated, we bring them back. So then you have to ask, how religiously meaningful would it be if the Vatican really did have some of these things? Which, do we know? I don't know if we know anything about them, but let's say that they do. And if they gave them back, that would be a tremendous fulfillment of exactly what is happening here in Ezra and Nehemiah as well. Exactly.
If we get vessels back from those places of betrayal, do we have to toy for them again? Is there a way to kasher them that we could use them again?
Oh, right. So you have to learn Hilchot Tarot. No one knows how to purify anything nowadays. So we definitely have work to do to make that happen. I think there might be one other layer to understanding the vessels. Right, why is it so significant that the vessels are taken away and the vessels are brought back? And I think there we might be able to say that it's part of how complete the redemption is. Right? We expect a complete rejuvenation. That's what Koresh is promising us. We're going to build the Beit Hashem in Yerushalayim, and we're going to return to the way things were before. And so having the vessels that we used before brought back, we're back in the same Beit HaMikdash. Now, the building itself is destroyed. There's no way to physically reconstruct the same building from the same materials. That's impossible. But what we can do is bring back all the accoutrements, all the details, all the shulchan and the menorah and everything that was part of the Mikdash. And so when Koresh says, I'm going to give this all back to you, wow. Because we're really able to rebuild just like things were. Just like the way we want things to be. And that, I think, is a really powerful, aspirational picture for the beginning of the book of Ezra. Koresh, a quasi-prophetic figure, is spoken to by Hashem and is commanded basically to build the Mikdash back at in as much glory as you can imagine. As glorious as it was at the beginning. Now, that is the vision. That's the chazon of how things could be. We'll see next week, in terms of how it actually plays out, that things don't go exactly according to plan. Okay.
Thank you
very much.